Your cleaning lady left the door open. Do you know Aubrey Davenport? That got his attention. He struggled to fight his way through a substance-induced fog. I work for her, he said. Well, technically she fired me, but she'll take me back. She always does. When did you last see her? He closed his eyes and squeezed out an answer. Friday. You sure you didn't see her last night? The eyes popped open, angry, challenging. I told you. She fired me. The bitch makes me repent for a week before she calls and gives me another chance. It's all part of her twisted dance. Where were you last night? He gave a nod at his ravaged apartment. Party for one. I don't think so, Kylie said. Aubrey's car is parked around the corner. We know she was here last night. That stumped him. He scrunched his eyes tight again, rummaged through his muddled memory bank, and came up with insufficient funds. She was? You tell us, Yannick. He sat forward on the edge of the sofa and massaged his temples. I don't know, maybe she was. My brain is a little fuzzy since Friday. Why the hell don't you ask her if she was here? Kylie squatted, leaned in so close that she was practically eyeball to eyeball with him, and whispered, I can't ask her. She's dead.
Dead?
The wheels inside his steroid-addled head were turning now, and I could see that he was finally on the verge of being able to put two and two together.
And is that why you're here? Do you think I killed her?
We don't think you killed her, I said, tired of letting my partner have all the fun. We know you killed her. She parked her car nearby, and the two of you took your car to Roosevelt Island, where you tied her up, whipped her, choked her to death, came home, and fired up your amnesia pipe, hoping it would all go away. It won't. The only thing going away will be you. He stared at me with his high beams on.
Roosevelt Island? Near the big old haunted house?
If we had taken him into custody, we would have had to warn him that anything he said could be used against him. But we hadn't arrested him, and cops are not required to stop a chatterbox from incriminating himself. Now it's coming back to you, isn't it? I said. That's where we found her body. You're in deep shit, Yannick, but we can help. Tell us everything now, and we'll see to it that you get brownie points with the DA's office. Silence. Kylie sat down on the sofa next to him, put a hand on his shoulder, and spoke softly.
Get it off your chest, Yannick. Tell us the truth. Did you kill her?
He shook his head and began to sob.
I don't know. I don't remember.
Chapter 10. There are two ways to search a suspect's apartment. Get a warrant, which would take hours, or con the tenant into giving us permission, which in Yannick Hoffman's case would take seconds. Kylie took the lead.
Let's go easy on him, Zach, she said, her hand still on our prime suspect's shoulder. So he can't remember anything. That doesn't make him guilty. Maybe he didn't do it.
That's the genius of Kylie MacDonald. A few minutes before, she was kicking the guy when he was down, trash-talking him, using every trick in the bad cop's handbook to goad a confession out of him. Now she was Detective Mother Teresa, and it was my turn to put on the bad cop pants.
Maybe he didn't do it, I bellowed, and maybe when he wakes up tomorrow morning he'll be 6'2".
I kicked my voice up an octave.
He's a juicer, a crackhead, and now he's a murderer. All the DA has to do is get up in front of a jury and say two words, roid rage, and this sackless wonder will spend the next 40 years doing drop sets in the prison yard at Green Haven.
At least give him a chance to prove he's innocent. She turned to Hoffman. Can you do that, Yannick? Can you prove you were here last night?
He gave it his best shot.
I might have had some friends over. I could call around and see if any of them...
Friends lie, Kylie said. You have to do better than that.
He shook his head. His reservoir of ideas dried up.
What about takeout food? Kylie said. Did you get a delivery last night?
Probably. I mean, I order in all the time.
He pointed with pride at the array of pizza boxes, Chinese food containers, and other roach bait rotting on the kitchen table.
We can call and see if any of the delivery guys remember.
They won't fly, Kylie said. The DA thinks delivery guys lie even more than friends. Let's look around and see if we can find a receipt with the date on it. Yannick thought that was a stellar idea and was grateful when we offered to help search the apartment for his meal ticket to freedom. We neglected to tell him that if we happened to stumble on a tripod, it would be admissible evidence. Since it took us less than a minute to find a couple of crack pipes and a bag of weed in his dresser drawer, we realized that hiding shit from the cops wasn't his strong suit. After 10 minutes, we knew the tripod wasn't in the apartment. My ex was in the film business, Kylie said, once we'd come up empty-handed. I'm surprised this place isn't cluttered with camera equipment.
It all belongs to Aubrey, Yannick said. She keeps it in her office. Did you find any receipts yet?
No, which means you still don't have an alibi, Kylie said. Give me your cell. The GPS might tell us if you were here last night. Without missing a beat, he passed her his phone. And I wondered why the hell an intelligent photojournalist like Aubrey Davenport would spend more than 10 minutes with this brain-dead Neanderthal. If we had any doubts that Yannick was a narcissist, they were put to rest when we opened his photo app. There were gigabytes of selfies of him oiled up and stripped down to nothing but the classic ball-cupping posing thong. And then we found what we thought was pay dirt. A series of pictures of Aubrey, fully clothed, standing in front of Renwick Smallpox Hospital. What are these? Kylie asked him.
That's the place, he said.
What place?
The creepy place on Roosevelt Island where you said you found her.
What were the two of you doing there?
Aubrey thought she might want to do a documentary about it. A lot of people died there, and death really turned her on. She'd rather have sex in a cemetery than a 5-star hotel. Did you have sex there?
I asked.
Shit, man. We had sex everywhere.
These are dated last October, I said. Have you been back there since?
A couple of times. But not in the winter. And definitely not last night.
We delved into his contacts, his phone log, his browser history, his text messages, and dozens of unappetizing sexts between him and Aubrey. But other than finding out that they had a twisted long-term love-hate-work-sex relationship, there was no evidence to link him to a murder. My text alert beeped, and I checked my phone. It was Mally. I know who made your bomb. Meet me at 26 Fed. It took me a beat to put it together, and then it all came flooding back. The silver bullet dinner. A smiling Del Fairfax suddenly ripped in half. A tiny pigtail of red, white, and blue wire. I'd become so immersed in the narrow world of Yannick Hoffman that for a few glorious minutes, I'd totally forgotten that Kylie and I had another homicide to solve. Chapter 11. I showed the text to Kylie. At least the FBI's got their act together, she said. We're not getting anywhere with this lunk. How are we supposed to figure out if he killed Aubrey if he can't figure it out himself? Yannick was out cold on the sofa, snoring like a bear. I doubt if he's a flight risk, I said. I doubt if there's a risk of him getting out of the apartment. The sun was up when we left the building, and the air was thick with the heady aroma of something sweet and irresistible. We followed our noses to a tiny bakery on the corner of Java Street. The sign on the window said Zhizoska, which I decided meant the best place in New York to get cheese babka, poppy seed rolls, blackberry Danish, and if you want coffee, find a Starbucks. We did, and we drove back to Manhattan, restoring our souls in the grand tradition of cops everywhere, wolfing down sugary pastries and deconstructing the events of the past 12 hours. The Jacob K. Javits Federal Building at 26 Federal Plaza on Foley Square is 41 stories of steel, glass, and red tape. It houses a multitude of government agencies, including Homeland, GSA, Social Security, Immigration, and on the 23rd floor, the New York Field Office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Howard Mally was waiting for us in his office. "Do you accept bribes?" Kylie asked, dropping what was left of the Polish goodies onto his desk.
"It's the first thing they teach us at Quantico," Mally said, digging into the bag and pulling out a piece of apple cake. "I found your bomb maker. He's a master, one of the best in the business.
Name? Kylie said, pen and pad in hand. Real name is Flynn Samuels, but Interpol gave him a code name, Sammy Six Digits.
Six Digits?
He doesn't sound that masterful.
That's that wacky French sense of humor. The guy has all 10 fingers, but he always uses a symbolic 6-digit date to trigger his bombs. So like if he wanted to blow up Independence Hall, he might go with July 4th, 1776, and use 741776.
What numbers did he use to set off this one?
Impossible to tell,
Mally said, putting away half a square of cake in a single bite.
But last night's blast has his signature all over it. His specialty is shaped charges designed to take out a single target. And remember the red, white, and blue wires? You thought that meant he was American. You were close. He's Australian. And guess what colors their flag is?
Do you have a mugshot? We'll put out a citywide bolo.
Don't bother. He's in a prison in Thailand. 15 years ago, he built the bomb that killed their Minister of Justice. He was neat, clean, and did the job without any collateral damage. But the people behind the assassination were stupid and got caught. They were facing the death penalty, so they made a deal. They gave up their bomb maker in exchange for a lighter sentence. The cops arrested Samuels at the Bangkok airport just as he was about to get on a plane for Australia. The next morning, the bozos that hired him were executed by machine gun. Samuels wasn't so lucky. They decided to let him rot in a Thai prison.
Then he must have a disciple, Kylie said. Someone he taught the tricks of his trade.
I doubt it. Samuels commanded top dollar to create one-of-a-kind bombs. Blowing people up was his livelihood. He didn't have disciples. He was too smart to share his secret sauce recipe.
Do you have any idea when he gets out of prison?
I asked. Mally reached into the bag and plucked out a gooey Danish.
Good question, Zach. Let me check my calendar. Oh, wait, it's Thailand. Never.
Chapter 12. We drove back to the precinct, where I showered, shaved, and grabbed a change of clothes from my locker. By the time I got to my desk, Kylie had already cleaned up and was checking her email.
We got a gratitude note from Mayor Sykes. She tapped her computer screen. Take a look.
My mind was too preoccupied with Cheryl for me to care about reading an attaboy from the mayor. How about you just give me the executive summary?
Sure,
she said, swiveling her chair away from the screen.
Blah, 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 Jordan and McDonald, quick thinking, blah, 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 Jordan and McDonald, excellence and valor, plus 4 more paragraphs of blah, blah, blah. Bottom line, we are the flavor of the month.
I'm not sure if that's a blessing or a curse.
That's the beauty of politics, Zach. It's both. All wrapped up in a digital love letter, with copies to Cates, the Chief of D's, and the PC himself.
She stood up.
We should get out of here. Our backup team is waiting for us at the diner.
I'll meet you there, I said. Give me 5 minutes to stop on the second floor and say hello to the department psychologist.
She looked at her watch.
5 minutes? Really?
Maybe 10. I might think of something else to say besides hello.
I took the stairs down to Cheryl's office. She was at her desk, reading, dark brown eyes fixed on the thick binder in front of her, wavy jet-black hair framing her face and resting on her shoulders. I stood in the open doorway and thought, God, she's gorgeous. Or maybe I said it out loud, because she raised her head, sang out my name, came around to the other side of the desk, pulled me into the room, closed the door, grabbed me in her arms, and gave me a long, slow, lingering kiss. She looked, smelled, felt, and tasted like heaven.
You're alive, she said.
I'm becoming more alive by the second,
I said, as she dug her hips into mine. I backed off reluctantly.
Let's not start anything we can't consummate. I've got 2 fresh homicides to work. Can we pick this back up again at dinner?
Oh, we will,
she said, letting me go.
But fair warning, I know you didn't get any sleep last night. Don't expect to get much tonight either.
She kissed me again, and I left the room happy and horny. I double-timed it around the corner to Jerry's Diner and found Kylie at a booth in the rear with our backup team. Danny Corcoran is second-generation NYPD, who did his 20 and is 2 years into his next 5. As usual, he was well-dressed, sporting a gray off-the-rack suit from one of the city's better racks. Hair challenged, he topped off the look with a gray newsboy cap. Always on the wrong side of the body fat index, his round Irish face lit up when he saw me, and he tore himself away from a stack of pancakes with a side of sausage to give me a fierce bear hug.
"Still on that health kick?"
I said, pointing to his lumberjack breakfast. And Danny responded by not so subtly scratching the tip of his nose with his middle finger. Then he introduced me to Tommy Fisher, who, like all of Danny's partners over the years, was the quiet type.
"Foreplay is over," Kylie said. "Cut to the chase, boys."
"We hit the garage at about 3 a.m. and found her car," Danny said. "The attendant who punched her in was long gone, so we got his home address and paid him a visit."
"Did he remember her?" I asked.
"Oh, yeah. She greased him $20 to keep her car up top in one of those golden spots reserved for good tippers. She said she'd be back soon, but of course she never showed."
"Had he seen her before?"
"She wasn't a regular, but she'd park there from time to time, mostly overnight. A few times he remembers her driving in with some yabo half her age. He called him a young Arnold Schwarzenegger."
"Sounds like the boy we like for the murder," I said. "Name is Yannick Hoffman. He's our cameraman. Where's the car now?"
"Impounded. The lab guys are dusting and probing."
"How about her apartment?" Kylie asked.
"It's like the Barbie dream house for the terminally oversexed."
He handed Kylie his cell phone.
"Scroll through some of the highlights."
Corcoran had taken pictures of a closet full of sex paraphernalia that for most people would be taboo, but for Aubrey Davenport was the norm. I looked over Kylie's shoulder as she flipped through the pictures in a hurry. By now, we knew enough about Aubrey's world not to be surprised.
"Drugs?"
Kylie asked. Fisher flipped open a notepad. "Ecstasy, coke, poppers, weed, plus scripts for Paxlon Zoloft," he said. "The prescribing doc's name is Morris Langford. Here's his number." He tore off a page and handed it to me.
"We're looking for her video cameras and her computer," I said. "You find any in her apartment?"
"Nothing." "How about her office?"
"It was closed, so we left a pair of uniforms in front of the door," Corcoran said. "They called a few minutes ago. Her assistant just opened up. His name is Troy Martian. They're holding him. You want us to talk to him?"
"We'll take it," I said. "I'd rather you go back to the parking lot attendant and show him a photo lineup of six young Arnold Schwarzeneggers. One of them should be Yannick Hoffman. He can dig out five more from the files." Danny stuck his fork back into the stack of hotcakes and grinned.
"I only need four more," he said. "The fifth one can be a selfie."
Chapter 13. Aubrey's office was on West 17th Street in the Flatiron District near Union Square. A squad car was parked outside. The directory in the lobby said Davenport Films 303. We took the elevator to the third floor and found a uniformed officer standing outside the door.
"Officer Hairston," I said, reading her name tag. "You were here when the assistant showed up?"
"Yes, sir. He wanted to know what was going on, so my partner and I told him that his boss was found dead. Was that okay?"
"It wasn't, but I decided to let it go. Kylie, on the other hand, is a lot less forgiving."
"No, it's not okay," she snapped. "Detectives can learn a lot just by watching how people react when they're told someone is dead. Now we have to rely on secondhand information." "How'd he take the news?"
"He freaked out."
"People freak out when they hit the lottery, officer. If you're going to play detective, do a better job of it."
"Sorry, ma'am. He was all broke up when we told him. Not crying, but very upset. Devastated. Heartbroken."
"Heartbroken like he was banging her?"
"No, ma'am. More like his boss was dead and he's out of a job. He kept saying, 'What am I going to do now?' Anyway, I doubt if he was banging her. He's gay."
"Oh, really?" Kylie said. "And how did you jump to that conclusion?"
"He asked if he could call his fiancée for moral support, and we said yes. The fiancée turns out to be another dude. It came up gay in my book."
It was a small victory for Hairston, and to her credit, she kept a straight face. She opened the office door, gestured for her partner to step out, and Kylie and I stepped in. except for a few light stands and a 20-foot roll of seamless background paper covering one wall. The room was nothing more than a wide-open, high-ceilinged photo studio. There were two desks, a makeup vanity with a lighted mirror, a stylist chair, and a kitchenette where two men in their early 30s were sitting at a table, each with a coffee mug in front of him. They say opposites attract, but not in this case. The two men looked a lot alike. Each was slender, with a patch of thinning dark hair on his head and the dark shadow of designer stubble on his face. One was wearing a blue shirt, the other one was in yellow. Blue Shirt stood up.
"I'm Troy Marchand, Aubrey's assistant. Do you know who killed her?"
"Not yet, but we're working on it."
I turned to Yellow Shirt.
"And what's your name, sir?"
"Dylan Fremont. I didn't know her. I mean, I met her a few times, but that's all. I'm just here to help Troy get through this. Hey, can I ask you a question?"
"It works better when we ask the questions," Kylie said.
"Yeah, I watch a lot of cop shows, but I just want to know, is it true what they're saying about Aubrey on the web?"
"What are they saying?"
"Some real kinky shit was going on before she got killed."
"And where did you hear that?"
"As soon as Troy called me, I did a search for Aubrey's name on social media, and a couple of those celebrity news feeds. They say she was found at some haunted house on Roosevelt Island, and that there was some weird sex going on before she died. Is it true?"
"NYPD doesn't comment on internet gossip," Kylie said.
"I wouldn't be surprised if it was true," Troy said. "All her life, Aubrey was obsessed with two things, sex and filmmaking. How ironic if that's how she died."
"Gentlemen," Kylie said, "we're trying to catch a killer, and you're wasting valuable time. Mr. Marchand, the first thing we need from you is your boss's computer. You can either give it to us, or we can get a court order."
"I'd give it to you if I had it, but I don't. Aubrey always had her laptop with her. It's probably in her apartment."
"It's not. Can you think of anybody who might be holding it for her? We really need to get a look at all her files."
Troy shook his head. "Aubrey wouldn't trust anybody with her computer. Maybe it's in the trunk of her car."
"It's not," Kylie repeated.
"It doesn't matter," Troy said. "She backed up everything religiously. I can retrieve the files from the cloud. It'll take me a couple of hours."
"Thank you," Kylie said. "When you're done, give them to the two officers outside. They'll get it to us. We also need to look at her camera equipment."
"This way," he said,
walking us toward the rear of the studio.
"It's not very impressive. It's mostly old crap that she can't throw away. If she's shooting anything important, she rents."
He unlocked a closet door. Inside, there were metal storage racks, cluttered with cameras, lenses, cases, and most promising of all, tripods.
"Lock it up," I said. "We'll send a team to go over it. Who else besides you has a key?"
"Just Aubrey."
"How about her cameraman?"
Troy made a face.
"Yannick? Hell no. This stuff may not be worth a lot, but give him a key and it would wind up on Craigslist."
"You don't think highly of Mr. Hoffman?"
"The guy's a loser. I never understood what she was doing with him."
"He's probably the one who..."
My cell rang, and he stopped.
I recognized the number on caller ID. The phone rang a second time, but I didn't pick up.
"Go ahead, Mr. Marchand."
"Don't you have to answer that?"
"It can wait. Finish your thought, please."
"Yannick Hoffman is a brute, an addict with a violent temper. He always scared the shit out of me. I'm not saying he killed her, but if it turns out he did, I wouldn't exactly be surprised." I nodded, and mentally added Troy Martian's name to the list of witnesses for the prosecution. Then I turned away and answered the phone on the fourth ring.
"Madam Mayor," I said, trying to sound as upbeat as I could. "And how are you this fine morning?"
Chapter 14.
Madam Mayor was anything but fine on this fine morning. She was pissed to the gills, and she let loose a stream of profanity, which, while unbecoming of her office, was totally in keeping with her gritty Hell's Kitchen roots. The good news was that her anger was not aimed at her Flavor of the Month cops. She went off on Arnie Zimmer, one of the three surviving founders of the Silver Bullet Foundation. "The son of a bitch called me, at home, no less," she said, seething. "He told me he didn't like the way I, or my overhyped police force,
was handling the vicious attack on his charity and the brutal murder of his partner.
Ma'am, Kylie and I just met with the FBI bomb expert and we're working as fast as—
Zach! Don't get defensive. I didn't call to ask why you haven't solved a major crime 12 hours after it happened. All I need right now is for you to get this cocksucker off my back.
One of the first things you learn as a cop is that if it's important to your hook, it's important to you. And there are not too many better hooks than the woman who runs the city. Diffusing Arnie Zimmer shot straight to the top of my things-to-do list.
Where can I find him?
I asked.
He's rounded up the other two partners. They're at Princeton Wells' place. They're expecting you.
She hung up. 15 minutes later, Kylie and I pulled up to a magnificent brick and limestone Beaux-Arts facade on Central Park West. In a city full of ridiculously expensive real estate, there aren't many private homes that can be called mansions. Princeton Wells's place, as the mayor had called it, was one that could. I rang the doorbell, expecting to be greeted by a butler wearing a proper black morning coat, gray striped trousers, and a white wing collar shirt. Instead, Wells himself came to the door, dressed like he was ready to pose for the cover of the J. Crew catalog.
"Sorry about this," he said, shaking his head. "Arnie is on a tear."
"It's understandable," I said, using some of the language they taught me in NYPD Red Charm School. "He may just be getting over the shock of last night."
"I doubt it," Wells said, walking us through a sprawling foyer and up a sweeping marble staircase. "Arnie is a notorious micromanager. It ain't soup unless he's stirred the pot.
The mayor said he's not happy with the way we're handling the case. We'll do what we can to reassure him that—"
"Save your breath," Wells said. "Arnie already tore the mayor a new one. You're just here so he can vent to the cops."
Kylie gave me a subtle nod. One of the qualifications for joining a police force dedicated to working with the uber-rich is being able to put up with their verbal abuse while you're busting your ass to help them. It's the shit part of the job, and I'm much better at it than Kylie is. The nod was a message. It was my turn to stand between her and the bullets. On the other hand, one of the best parts of the job is getting a taste of the mind-boggling creature comforts that unlimited wealth can buy. But this time, we hadn't been invited to soak up the grandeur. We were there to take our lumps. "They're in my office," Wells said when we got to the second floor. He opened a mahogany door, and we stepped into a vast room with wood-paneled walls, a soaring ceiling, leather furniture, and all the trappings of an old-school private men's club. I took a few seconds to fantasize what it must feel like to sit down at the end of a tough day and enjoy a well-earned snifter of single malt whiskey. The fantasy fizzled as soon as Wells made the introductions. I'd done a quick background check on the players before we got there. Nathan Hirsch was a $1,000-an-hour banking and finance attorney with an Ivy League pedigree and a blue-chip resume. He was a lot less impressive in person. Overweight and straining the good graces of his designer's suit, he smelled of cigar. His handshake was clammy, and his eyes never made contact with mine. My cop radar kicked in, and I wondered if he was still reeling from last night, or if he had another reason to be twitchy. Arnie Zimmer, who owned the Zim Construction Group, was taller and thinner, and wasted no time taking on the mantle of designated bully.
"Do you know how much I gave to Muriel Sykes's election campaign?"
he asked, ignoring my extended hand.
"No, sir," I said.
"Enough money so that I shouldn't be paying for hind tit.
If Sykes expects a nickel out of me when she runs for re-election, she better put the two of you on this case 24/7.
"Sir, we're sorry for the loss of your friend, but we are on the case. We haven't slept since the bomb exploded."
"Don't bullshit a bullshitter.
I've got friends in the department. You're splitting your time between a page one terrorist attack and some page 37 sex crime."
"Mr. Zimmer, we understand your frustration, but I can assure you that Mayor Sykes has made this our number one priority. And we're not working alone. The FBI has already helped us identify the person who built the bomb."
"I don't care if Lockheed Martin built the fucking bomb. Your job is to figure out who set it off."
"Dell was in construction,
Did it ever dawn on you that contractors use explosives? Why don't you start there? It was probably some pissed-off asshole who lost out on one of Dell's jobs. And with that, the pissed-off asshole left the room.
Meeting adjourned?
I asked Wells. He smiled.
Arnie called it. Arnie gets to pull the plug on it.
I'll tell the mayor you represented her admirably.
I'd much rather you just gave Mr. Zimmer my phone number, I said, holding out my card.
Detective, you saw what he can be like. Are you sure you want him badgering you?
Anytime. As long as he stops badgering the mayor.
He took the card reluctantly. Nathan and I will do what we can to keep him at bay, but Arnie's a pit bull. He's going to give you problems.
I shrugged off the comment, but it turned out to be an understatement. Arnie Zimmer gave us more problems than anyone ever anticipated.
Chapter 15. I was ready to leave, but Kylie, who hadn't said a word since we got there, wasn't. One question before we go, she said to Wells. Which one of you knew the real Del Fairfax? You or Mr. Zimmer?
Wells looked confused.
I'm sorry, Detective, the four of us have been friends since high school. I don't understand the question. Last night we told you that the blast analysis indicated that Mr. Fairfax was the primary target, and we asked you if he had any enemies. Do you remember what you said?
Not word for word, but the answer is no. People liked him.
I took notes. Last night you said, everybody loved him. Hell, they love the four of us. Then you suggested that the bomb was intended for the mayor. Now, this morning, Mr. Zimmer has a different perspective. He's saying it's a disgruntled contractor out to settle a score, but he stormed off before we could ask him if there were any specific contractors he might point us to. So let me repeat what I asked you last night. Can you think of anyone, especially in the building trades, who didn't love Mr. Fairfax and would want to see him dead?
All right, I get it, Wells said. I painted a pretty rosy picture last night.
But you're right. We give away a lot of money, but we can't give it to everybody. We can't support every cause. We can't award jobs to everybody who bids on one. We make some people incredibly happy, and we can disappoint the shit out of others. That's life. That's business. It's not a motive for murder. Kylie turned to Hirsch. Counselor, we need all the help we can get. Do you have anything you could add?
If he did, he didn't look anxious to share it. But Kylie hadn't made it easy for him to say no. Arnie means well, but I think he's wrong, Hirsch said, choosing his words carefully. Last night's insanity wasn't payback for some kind of a business grudge. I want you to solve Dell's murder as much as anybody, but please, don't waste your time looking for vindictive contractors.
Who should we look for? According to Mr. Wells, everybody loves the four of you.
Hirsch forced a smile. Detective, I'm a lot more cynical than Princeton. We live in a city of haves and have-nots. I'm sure there are plenty of people out there who were happy to hear that somebody blew up a room full of rich white do-gooders. I hope that helps.
It helped more than he realized. We thanked the two of them and didn't say a word till we were back in the car.
Nicely done, partner, I said. Did you suspect Hirsch had something to hide? Or did you just go fishing and get lucky?
A little of both. Did you notice where he was sitting last night?
Yeah. He was at a table close to the front, slightly off to the left.
And did you notice what he did when Princeton Wells introduced his girlfriend to the crowd?
No. But I imagine he was doing what most men in the room were doing, admiring Miss Whitehouse and thanking the cleavage gods.
He wasn't. And while your eyes were honed in on Kenda's boobs, I watched Nathan Hirsch quietly get up from the table and leave the room. My cell phone rang. I was about to let it go to voicemail when I saw who was calling. I picked up.
This is Detective Jordan.
Detective, this is Dr. Langford. I'm returning your call. I was Aubrey Davenport's psychiatrist. I'm in shock over her death. The reports on the internet say it was homicide. Is that true?
Yes, sir. My partner and I would like to talk to you. We could come to your office immediately.
That's impossible, he said.
and I braced myself for the usual doctor-patient confidentiality resistance. I'm at a medical conference in Albany. I couldn't possibly get back to the city till tomorrow morning. I realize time is of the essence, but we can't do this over the phone. Most of my notes are in my office.
But you'll help us? I said.
Of course I'll help you. The law forbids me to share information about my living patients, but Aubrey's death frees me to help you in any way I can. I'll gather her files, and we can meet in my office tomorrow at 10 a.m. He gave me the address, and we hung up.
Good news on the Davenport case, I told Kylie. Now, where were we on Fairfax?
You were ogling Kenda Whitehouse's tits, and I was wondering why Nathan Hirsch would go to the men's room instead of waiting a few more minutes until the mayor got up and said her piece. But now I'm thinking, what a lucky coincidence. Nathan left the room right before the bomb went off. She smiled. And you know how cops feel about luck or coincidence. Chapter 16. It was time to dig deeper into the lives of Del Fairfax's surviving partners. Fortunately, there was no shortage of material. These guys generate a lot of ink, Kylie said.
People with no money love to read about people who have mountains of it, I said. The world is full of hermits, loners, and recluses, but Howard Hughes was a billionaire, so the press made him famous for it. We were looking for a motive for the bombing, but in article after article, interview after interview, the four founders came across as model citizens. Princeton Wells had summed it up the night before. Nobody wants to kill the golden goose. Silver Bullet doesn't have enemies. By 1 p.m., we'd raked over their public persona, and there wasn't enough Red Bull on the planet to get us started looking under their private rocks. After pulling a 30-hour shift, we punched out. I went home, slept 5 hours, showered, and showed up at Cheryl's apartment at 7. The heady aroma of jambalaya hit me as soon as she opened the door. She had a wooden spoon in her hand, so I gave her a quick kiss, and she hustled back to the stove while I made straight for the open bottle of Chardonnay on the counter. "Can I violate one of our cardinal rules tonight?" she asked, spooning mounds of chicken, shrimp, sausage, rice, and chopped vegetables into a serving bowl.
"Just give me half a minute to inhale some of this wine, and you can violate anything you want."
"Reel it in, lover boy. I'm talking dinner table rules."
"You mean the one where Zach can't use his phone at the table, but Cheryl can because she's a doctor?"
"That one is chiseled in stone, but I'd like to bend the no-cop-talk-at-dinner rule. I've been getting second-hand news about the bombing all day, and I want the unsanitized version." We sat down to dinner, and in between forkfuls of spicy Creole bliss and sips of chilled fruity Chardonnay, I took her through it all, glossing over the carnage and milking absurdities like Kenda Whitehouse's post-explosion bad hair for all the laughs I could get. By the time I got to the verbal drubbing we'd taken from Arnie Zimmer, the bottle of wine was empty.
"You must be exhausted," she said, opening another.
"And you haven't even come up with a motive for the bombing yet."
"Plus, I still have a second high-profile murder on my hands. Which reminds me, did you ever hear of a shrink named Morris Langford?"
"Maury Langford? Yes, he's the go-to doc on psychosexual disorders. Why'd you ask?"
"Kylie and I are going to see him tomorrow."
"Oh, sweetheart, that's wonderful," she said, refilling my wine glass. "It's about time you and Kylie came to terms with your issues. I'm sure Maury can help you."
"Thanks. But I get all the therapy I need from Jerry at the diner. It's free with breakfast, whether I ask for it or not. My other homicide victim, Aubrey Davenport, was a patient of Langford's, and he agreed to help. Didn't throw any of the standard HIPAA bullshit at us."
"That sounds like Maury. He's a no-bullshit kind of guy. I had a consult with him a few months ago."
"Are you serious? You went to see a sex therapist a few months ago and you didn't say anything to me?"
"Get a grip, Romeo. It wasn't about you. I'm a department shrink. You think I only deal with PTSD and alcohol abuse? Cops have at least as many sexual impulse disorders as congressmen. It's none of my business until they either bring it to me on their own or someone from on high asks me to evaluate how it could impact their job."
"Why did you consult with Langford?"
"I had a transit cop who was suffering from frotcherism, and I had zero experience with it.
Langford knew it chapter and verse.
I never even heard of it.
Good. And please promise me you will continue to remain blissfully unsophisticated.
Unsophisticated? Come on. Doc, how can you say that? You've seen my moves. All three of them.
Hmm, she said, her eyes locked on mine, her fingers twirling a lock of raven hair. There were three? I stood up, took her by the hand, and put my arms around her.
You know, I think I'm coming down with a case of sexual impulse disorder myself.
She began kissing my neck.
I'm a doctor, she whispered. Why don't you step into my office and take off your clothes? I may be able to help.
I think you're helping already, I said, rotating my hips in time with hers.
Are you sure there were three? She said, leading me to the bedroom. I think I'm going to have to sign up for a refresher course.
Chapter 17. By the time I got to the precinct the next morning, Kylie was already at her desk.
How was your evening? I asked.
Stellar, she said, with a gleam in her eye that challenged me to ask for the juicy details. When I didn't, she came back with, and how was yours?
Educational, I said. I learned a new word.
Educate me.
Frauderism.
It means, Zach, I know what it means. I arrested a guy for it. It happened a few years ago on the number 6 train. It was rush hour, the car was packed, and this dirtbag started rubbing his junk up against the woman standing next to him.
Most of these pervs don't get caught. Lucky for the woman, there was a cop on the train.
She grinned. Actually, it was unlucky for the perv that the ass he decided to rub against belonged to a cop. Her phone rang, and she picked it up. Hey, Jason, what have you got? Jason White is a recent transfer from NYPD's real-time crime center and our back door into the private lives of private people. He's the big brother who can track anyone's digital footprints. Yesterday, after we'd come up empty-handed, we recruited him to see what he could find on Wells, Hirsch, and Zimmer. Thanks, Kylie said, hanging up. She turned to me. Nathan Hirsch lives with his wife and three kids in Forest Hills Gardens, Queens, but he also rents an apartment on Hudson Terrace in Fort Lee, New Jersey. And his Easy Pass has him going over the GW Bridge every Thursday around 3 p.m.
Maybe the apartment is for his ailing mother, and good son that he is, he visits once a week.
According to Jason, Mom is black, has implants the size of disco balls, and goes by the name of Tiffany Wilde.
How the hell does he dig that shit up so fast?
I'm curious, too, but it would be unwise of us to ask. The less we know, the more honest we can be on the witness stand.
So Nervous Nathan's got himself some sugar on the side, I said. That's grounds for divorce, but it's not a motive for murder. And it's definitely not enough to convince the DA to give us the green light to run trap and trace devices on three philanthropists who fight for the less fortunate.
But you know the rich, Kylie said, holding up a finger. One dirty little secret is the tip of the iceberg. And if Nathan is into sex for money, Thursdays in Jersey won't be enough. And $1,000-an-hour lawyers who are into hookers don't cruise 12th Avenue looking for bargains.
No, they don't, I said. Those who can afford the best invariably reach out to New York's number one purveyor of quality female companionship for gentlemen of breeding and taste.
Get him on the phone and see if he knows any or all of the three amigos. Q. Lavish, who was born Quentin Luttrell, knows enough about the sex lives of the rich and famous to write a book. But since he's also the one who fulfills their kinkiest fantasies, he's as discreet as a mute in a monastery. With one exception. He'll share certain secrets with us. We, in turn, have been known to help him navigate the unfriendly waters of justice when one of his wealthy clients winds up handcuffed to a cop instead of to a bedpost. I called Q and put on the speaker so both Kylie and I could listen.
Detectives, he said. How can I be of service to New York's finest?
We have three persons of interest. We were hoping you might know something about their mating habits.
This is truly a fortuitous moment, he said. As luck would have it, I was going to call you, although I planned on waiting for a more civilized hour.
But who am I to complain about some lost sleep when the quid pro quo gods are smiling so brightly down upon us? May I tell you my conundrum?
We go first, Kylie said. Princeton Wells, Arnie Zimmer, Nathan Hirsch. Do you know any of them?
What child of the ghetto hasn't heard of the illustrious benefactors of the Silver Bullet Foundation? I'm guessing this is connected to the unfortunate incident at the Pierre Hotel.
No comment. Do you know them?
The first two only by reputation. But Macanudo Nate is a valued client. He has a fine appreciation for women of color.
What do you hear?
Apart from the fact that he smells like the inside of a humidor, none of my girls have ever said an unkind word about him.
Ask around, Kylie said.
Happily. But first, let me ask if you can reason with someone on my behalf.
Who?
He's a judge, and before you say no, he's also a client.
Then what's the problem?
He's accused me of blackmailing him.
Are you?
I said.
I will take that question as a lapse of judgment on your part rather than a condemnation of my character, Detective Jordan.
Get over it, Q. I'm a cop. It's how I roll. Who's the judge?
The Honorable Michael J. Rafferty.
What's the matter? You couldn't pick a beef with Attila the Hun? Rafferty is the biggest prick in the entire judiciary. Nobody likes him, and nobody can reason with him.
I'm sure that once you know the particulars, you'll find a way.
Lay them on us.
That can only be done face to face. Can I have Rodrigo drive me over to the 19?
We have a meeting off campus at 10. If he can be here by...
Hold on.
Kate's door flew open, and she came storming toward us, her heels echoing on the tile floor.
Get moving, she yelled, still at least 50 feet away. A bomb went off at 68th and York.
What's there?
A construction site. The blast was contained to a small field office. One person is dead.
Who? I said. But I knew the answer before I asked the question.
The owner of the company, Arnold Zimmer.
Chapter 18. Looks like Arnie Zimmer got what he was asking for, Kylie said, as we made our way to the blast site.
That's harsh, I said. The guy was a jerk, but he didn't deserve to die.
Jesus, Zach, I didn't say he got what he deserved. I said he got what he was asking for.
Us. Not quite, I said. He wanted us exclusively. Technically, he still got to share us with Aubrey Davenport.
Right now, Arnie Zimmer has our undivided attention. Aubrey's gonna have to wait. Why don't you call Dr. Langford and tell him we're gonna be late for our sex ed class?
Langford's calendar is jammed from 11 on, so we rescheduled for 8 p.m., which was the earliest he could see us. It was going to be another long day. The explosion took place on the campus of Rockefeller University, which is tiny as institutions of higher learning go, stretching only 5 blocks along York Avenue. But what it lacks in size, it makes up for in worldwide renown. Devoted to research and biomedical science, Rockefeller produces Nobel Prize laureates the way some schools turn out point guards for the NBA. Zim Construction was one of several contractors hired to add state-of-the-art laboratories and other buildings to the campus. And their field office, a steel box about 8 by 20 feet, was tucked into a corner away from most of the foot traffic. Howard Malley was waiting for us with a damage report.
One dead. Arnold Zimmer, the owner of the company. As far as we can ascertain, nobody else was injured, he said. From what I can piece together, the victim arrived about 7:30, unlocked the door, walked over to the air conditioner, and the bomb vaporized him.
Did he trip it when he turned on the AC? Kylie asked.
No. It was triggered wirelessly from outside. He would have been clearly visible from the street as he approached the window where the AC unit was mounted. The bomber just watched and waited.
Same bomb maker?
Same blast pattern. A shaped charge. But we still have to sift through the rubble and see if we can find some of the same signature elements.
Is there a crew boss or somebody in charge around here from the construction company? Kylie asked. We've got a few questions that you can't answer.
I like to think I can answer any and all questions. But if you're looking for the general superintendent, he was just here. I told him NYPD would want to talk to him. He works out of a field office near the 64th Street gate, but that's off limits till we get a canine unit to go through it. He's easy to spot. Big guy, about 6'4", work clothes, yellow hard hat. His name's Bill Neal.
Thanks, Kylie said. How soon can you let us know if we're looking at the same bomber as the hotel?
Mally grinned. Now that's a question I can't answer.
Kylie and I walked across the campus and saw Bill Neal standing under a tree, talking on his cell phone.
Mally was right. He was easy to spot. And with our badges on chains around our necks, so were we. Barbara, it's the police, he said into the phone. Let me call you back. I love you too.
He hung up the phone.
That was my wife, he said. She heard on the news that a bomb went off in a construction office at Rockefeller University, and she panicked. The FBI agent said you wanted to ask me some questions, but I was four blocks away when it happened. I heard the explosion, but I didn't see anything.
That's okay, I said. You can still help. How many people had keys to that office?
Arnie, me, and I don't know who else, but it doesn't matter. It's just your basic pin and tumbler lock. Anyone can open it with a paperclip and a tension wrench. A key is optional.
It's the boss's office, Kylie said. Wouldn't you have tighter security?
There's nothing in there worth securing. A desk, a couple of file cabinets, a fridge, a microwave, a coffee pot, and that's about it.
Surveillance cameras?
The university has cameras on the gates and peppered around the campus, but Arnie's office was in no man's land. It'd be easy enough for someone to scale the fence, pick the lock, and get away without anyone noticing.
Did Mr. Zimmer have any enemies? Kylie asked.
Neal shrugged. Sure, but not the kind that would blow him up. Arnie pissed a lot of people off. If something wasn't going the way he wanted, he was quick to get in people's faces. You guys ought to know.
Why would you say that?
Yesterday afternoon, Arnie told me he laced into the mayor. Then he read the riot act to a couple of her super cops because they weren't looking hard enough for whoever killed Del Fairfax. I figured that was you.
We're not super cops, I said.
But you're trying to solve the first bombing, and now you're on the second one. Do you have any leads?
We're working on it, I said.
And as soon as the words came out of my mouth, it dawned on me. That was the same promise I'd made to Arnie Zimmer just 24 hours earlier. Chapter 19. Kylie and I thanked Bill Neal and started walking back toward our car, which we'd been forced to abandon on 70th Street, because York Avenue had been clogged with emergency vehicles. By the time we got back to the blast site, some semblance of order had been restored. At least half of the fire trucks and patrol cars had been released, news vans were relegated to the side streets, and all civilian traffic from 61st to 72nd had been diverted to 1st and 2nd Avenues. That left two lanes open on York for official vehicles. I immediately recognized the black SUV parked in front of the 68th Street gate. It was the most official vehicle of them all.
Detectives!
A voice boomed. It was Charlie, the mayor's driver. He waved us over to the car, opened the back door, and Kylie and I slid into the back seat next to Muriel Sykes.
Yesterday, when I called you and asked you to get Arnie Zimmer off my back, this is not what I had in mind, she said. He has now managed to become a bigger pain in the ass to me dead than he was alive. I realize that the dust hasn't even settled, but do you have anything? One murder is a tragedy. Two is a conspiracy.
Madam Mayor, Kylie said, when Zack and I met with the three surviving Silver Bullet founders yesterday, Arnie tried to convince us that Del Fairfax was killed by a disgruntled contractor. If there's a conspiracy against them as a group, I'm sure it came as big a surprise to Zimmer as it did to us.
So you have nothing? No suspects? No leads?
Not yet.
What about Aubrey Davenport? She got bumped off the front page because of the bombing, but she's a big-name filmmaker, and the whole autoerotic asphyxiation thing is going to sell a lot of newspapers. Where are you on that?
We told her.
So this Yannick Hoffman, she said, going over the high points. He's her cameraman, and there's evidence of a tripod at the crime scene. The brother-in-law tells you that the guy is mentally and physically abusive. Davenport's car is parked a block from Hoffman's apartment, and he has no alibi for the time of the murder. It sounds to me like you have an incredibly viable suspect.
But we can't arrest him, I said. We don't have enough evidence to take to the DA.
Zach, I know the rules. I was a U.S. attorney, and when I ran for mayor, I pushed every law and order hot button I could. How is it going to look to the voters if I have two unsolved high-profile cases hanging over my head in my first 4 months? I need an arrest. And you're closer on this than you are on the bombings.
Madam Mayor, if we go to Mick Wilson and tell him we want to charge Yannick Hoffman, he'll kick us out of his...
I've got two words for our illustrious district attorney, she barked.
I braced myself for the inevitable mayoral F-bomb.
Selma Kaplan.
Ma'am?
Selma is the smartest ADA in New York County. If anyone can help me get a win on the front page, it's her. Plus, she's got the balls to stand up to Wilson. And she's loyal. We went to Brooklyn Law together. Talk to her and see what she can come up with.
She leaned over and yanked the door handle.
Please.
30 minutes later, Kylie and I were in the Louis J. Lefkowitz State Office Building, reconnecting with one of the best prosecutors in the business. Kaplan came around from behind her desk and shook our hands.
Detectives, I wish we could spend 20 minutes together rehashing past glories, she said. But the villagers are breaking the law faster than I can lock them up. The only reason you got past the wolf at the door is because my old friend Muriel has my cell number, and she's not ashamed to beg.
She gave me an overview, but tell me what you've got on this Yannick Hoffman.
Kylie and I filled her in, and when we were done, Kaplan shook her head and frowned.
If I'm going to get a conviction, I need more than some juicer playing 50 Shades of Weird with the victim and no alibi, she said.
We told the mayor we didn't think you could hang a case on it, I said.
I can't, she paused. But, and this is a big but, my gut tells me you've got enough circumstantial evidence to convince a grand jury to lock him up. Especially once they're told he's a flight risk who could hop a plane to Warsaw at any minute. Bring him in. I can get an indictment. That'll buy you enough time to either build a case against Hoffman, or to quote O.J., find the real killer.
Thanks, Selma, Kylie said. We owe you one.
No, sweetheart, Kaplan said. Muriel owes me one. And make sure you let her know that I plan to collect.
Chapter 20. The Miranda warning is eloquent in its simplicity. And yet a few seconds after we advised Yannick Hoffman that anything he said can and will be used against you in a court of law, he assured us that he understood his rights and then blurted out,
I didn't kill her, but if I did, I didn't mean it.
Kylie tossed me a grin that summed up what we were both thinking. We may not have enough evidence to convict this idiot, but with a little luck, he'll hang himself. In short order, he was assigned a lawyer from Legal Aid, arraigned, and remanded without bail. The mayor's spin doctors did their best to drum up media buzz for the arrest, but in a city whose mantra is, if you see something, say something, the two unsolved bombings dominated the airwaves. By 6:30, we'd wrapped up the paperwork. Since Dr. Langford's office was across town, we welcomed the opportunity for some new dining options and drove to Pizzeria Serenetta on Amsterdam Avenue for some rustic Italian fare. 90 minutes later, we parked at a hydrant on a tree-lined stretch of West End Avenue outside Langford's apartment building. Kylie and I had Googled him before we left the office. He was 47 and had written 5 books. And with his thick mop of ginger hair, surfer blue eyes, and camera-ready smile, he was the guy the TV stations called when they needed an expert.
Just our luck, Kylie said. Another pain-in-the-ass celebrity shrink.
The two of us had faced off with our share of A-list psychiatrists in the past, and humility is not their strong suit. Rule of thumb, the more famous they are, the more arrogant they can get.
Cheryl likes him, I told her. She says he's a no-bullshit kind of guy.
Cheryl's a lousy judge of character, Kylie said. Look at who she's dating.
It turned out that Cheryl was right. Langford was likable from the get-go. 2 minutes after we entered his waiting room, he stepped out of his office, walked his patient to the front door, and introduced himself.
Maury Langford, I've heard quite a bit about you both. I'm sorry to meet you under such tragic circumstances. I've been in a news-free zone since this morning. Have you made any progress?
Not enough, I said, and left it at that. I didn't want Hoffman's arrest to color any of Langford's comments. He shook his head and escorted us into his office. It was warm and inviting, with curtained windows, upholstered furniture, and a deep red Persian rug. And in lieu of the usual ego gallery of framed diplomas and degrees, the walls were decorated with vintage